we have to reframe failure to more around experimentation and it being the quickest way to success. And I think culturally in big corporates in particular, many organizations and many industries have some way to go to continue to break that down. And it probably links to how we define success quite often.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. And today we're delighted to be joined by Brian Murphy. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good to be with you.
Welcome to The Curious Advantage podcast, Brian. So, Brian, to start us off, why don't you tell us a little bit, what's it like to be leading career development for the global sales organization at Microsoft?
Well, thank you, Paul, and thanks, Simon and Garrick. It's great to be with you today. It's a real privilege to be invited, so thank you. The role at Microsoft is really exciting. So I'm here a little less than a year, and I guess it's another industry for me, right? So I've worked in banking, pharma, at really interesting times during those industries, the evolution of those industries. And now to be in big tech is just a new sort of a career phase for me. And I'm really enjoying it. It's a rare opportunity, I think, to come into a place like Microsoft, write your own job description, you know, build out a strategy, and in such an emergent area as career and skills. So, and then you layer on top of that the generative AI landscape that we're all exploring. It's I'm having a lot of fun, let's just put it that way.
Yeah, sounds like it. We've been reading some of your thoughts and your blogs and ideas online. One I'd like to jump straight into, you talk about skills being the new currency. Can we talk about that for a moment? How can organizations maximize their collective capabilities and increase speed and agility as they're trying to go through change?
You're starting me with an easy one.
Jump straight into the good stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I guess, you know, we hear a lot about this shift to skills and a skills-based approach. For me, it's a fairly, I guess there's three things that maybe I would talk about. The first is skills-based, not role-based, right? So if you think about the traditional approach to how we think about capability, it's usually based on role. So role is usually, or jobs are usually the proxy for both design and sizing work, and sizing and measuring organizational capability as a result. And so it's incredibly flawed, really. You know, it's been really limiting, right? And, you know, when's the last time do we see a job description that in any way reflected the dynamic nature of work, least of all the attempt to quantify and qualify the myriad of skills that the role holder could bring to the table. So I think the new approach, skills-based, really is exciting in that it allows us to think about the person as the unit of capability, but within that, how skills, how we can have a consistent way of using skills data to support that. And I'm talking about, you know, skills in a pretty broad sense, right? I'm including human capabilities in relation to that. And so I think it allows us to be much more adaptable and agile in our work design, allocation of you know, colleagues to that work. So deployment of skills and obviously development of skills as well. And, you know, we know this is already happening. So I think there was a Deloitte recently that talked about 63% of leaders say that the work in their organizations is currently being performed in teams or projects outside of people's core job descriptions, right? So that would be that first shift. The second would be how we adapt and thrive with the rise of AI. So we talked a bit about that on the intro. And I think it's about how we can find the way of harnessing this and how we can coexist and double down on what makes us uniquely human. Really topical to this podcast series, right? Our curiosity, our compassion, our creativity, our ability to truly connect, our empathy. So it's no coincidence, and I've been, you know, really enjoying my onboarding into Microsoft and learning about the legacy of what's come before my time here. And it's no coincidence in my mind that a company like Microsoft, which has been adopting AI for decades, really, but has put growth mindset, and I'm sure we'll get onto that, at the center of its business transformation, and continues to put it at the center of how we define success in the organization. So those human capabilities coexisting and being complementary to the digital transformation and the advance of AI, I think is going to be another way that we support organizational capability. And then really quickly, the third one for me is what I call meta career competency, something we're playing around with in my team at the company is, you know, what are, if we're going to embrace the skills-based approach, if we're going to adapt to machine and human coexistence, this will require us to be much more agile, adaptive. And this is where we think meta career competencies, such as learning to learn, such as working in digital networks, our ability to work and thrive in digital networks are going to be the key capabilities for us to focus on going forward. So, yeah, sorry, a bit of a long-winded answer, but these are probably three themes that come to mind when you pose that question.
And you pick up some pretty big topics there around, you know, what's the future role of humans as we move to the tech-centric way of working. You mentioned meta-career. What do you mean by that?
What I'm getting at there is, what are the capabilities that we're going to need going forward that will be sustaining? And so, you know, I think the capabilities, if we look at the half-life of skills, we look at certainly the half-life of a piece of a store of knowledge, you know, we think this is going to be, obviously, this is increasingly transient. I mean, never mind with ChatGPT and how we access information going forward. So we think about the critical capabilities to build and sustain careers going forward. That's what we're calling these meta career capabilities.
Maybe picking up on those, because I share the view of that you have on skills and a move from sort of jobs to skills as being sort of a long-term direction. You mentioned a couple of like learning to learn and sort of thriving in digital networks, but would love to hear sort of what are some of those critical skills that you're identifying as being things that people need to be focusing on in the future. And if someone sat out there thinking, okay, where do I invest my next 6 months of career development? What are the skills I should be focusing on? I know we see differences between technical skills and soft skills, but and maybe, you know, topical skills like ChatGPT. But, you know, what are you identifying from an organization perspective as being those meta career competencies or those sort of most critical skills?
I'm sure it actually these will resonate with a lot of the things you guys have been talking about in this podcast series. And I, by the way, I was fascinated to listen into the last podcast you guys did with Loretta Brunning on neuroscience around this and curiosity. It is brilliant. It really was brilliant. But the you know, I think for Simon, for the implications for us as learning in terms of what these skills will be is profound, because I think it's less about what helping people know what to learn, although you know, there's a big piece in that. And I think that with AI and with skills intelligence, I think we can do a much better job at signposting what are the skills they can deploy and develop to be in service of their career goals and the organizational goals. But I also think it's a lot of it is the science of learning itself and how we develop that learning muscle. And obviously that aligns nicely with curiosity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is why my team is really interested in these meta career skills. So we're partnering with Harold Jarque, for example, looking at his framework around personal knowledge mastery. We've done a lot of work I've done a lot of work in the past looking at professional learning networks and at AstraZeneca, you know, I know we work very closely with you guys and Ludic on how we develop learning agility and in support of digital transformation. So I think there's mindset and behavior shifts to support continuous learning. And then there are absolutely these capabilities and frameworks that we can help our people deploy. And by the way, I'll just give a really simple, practical one, because, you know, these things don't have to be overly complicated. So at AstraZeneca, we introduced with our manager population, really simple 4+1 question framework to support continuous learning in the flow of work. You know, what have you tried? What have you learned? What are you happy about? What aren't you happy about? And what do you do next? So there are capabilities and frameworks that we can help people to support continuous ongoing learning. And then there's more sophisticated ones, particularly around knowledge management as well. So, yeah, I think with L&D, and sorry to kind of fall into the to that side of the answer, but we can get sort of subsumed into a never-ending, probably flawed approach to focusing just on the what. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly our role should be to focus on the how of learning, and that will sustain, in my opinion.
I've got some questions about the how, but specifically from the technical side. I mean, you talked about data and the need to harvest data, which underpins this, and you talked about career data and all the other things that you're collecting. Two questions. How does the AI help you prepare or move into this kind of meta career competencies world? And practically, how is how are you using AI to do it? And the second one is, what tech platforms need to be in place to enable us to scale, you know, into this new world? In the past, we had buildings and we would get people together. Now we don't.
Well, and I'll have a go at answering this. And if I'm a bit parochial around L&D, pull me back out, right? So, I think we've been having this debate and discussion in the learning community and Microsoft around ChatGPT and how are we really going to take advantage of this generative AI. And, you know, as part of that debate, I've been sharing my team a point of view, which is, I think there's two existing themes that just, this will just help us to continue to accelerate. And one is that this point I made earlier on about the fact that it's less about storing knowledge and more about how we manage flows of knowledge and how we become knowledge experts rather than knowledge holders. And that's been a pre-existing kind of trend that we've been trying to enable across all of the teams that I've led. And I think ChatGPT will just continue to facilitate that in the sense that it's really going, I mean, we're already seeing it. I mean, blown away by this bot, right? I mean, we've been having a lot of fun with it in terms of playing around with it, but you can see the power and the ability of us to be able to access information when we need it in the flow and very much contextualized. So I think that's an existing trend that this will simply help facilitate. And then the other one is using this to support how we learn. So I know I'm preaching to the converted here, but a lot of traditional L&D organizations and leaders, some continue to maybe fall into the mistaken trap of thinking that we learn primarily through formal courses, content, and education, and it's obviously foundational and important, but it's we learn predominantly through experience and connection. And so the other thing we've been looking at with ChatGPT and these types of technologies is how can they be in service of experiential learning and connected learning? And you know, you could, for example, use it for a personal practice engine where sales folks are using this type of technology to support sales negotiation skills, role playing, etc. And you don't have to wait for the formal program, right? This can be really quickly applied. So I don't know if I've sort of moved away from your question, Garrick, but I think there are existing trends and shifts that we are looking to enable in L&D, which I think this type of technology, we shouldn't necessarily think that this is going to transform. I think we're already on a transformation journey. This is just going to enable.
Brian Murphy currently leads the global effort to reimagine career development at Microsoft. Brian's an international expert on learning and talent development. He's previously held senior HR and learning leadership roles at Citibank and AstraZeneca.
Maybe in a moment I'll come back to some of the pieces on sort of the role of learning and skills, but let's just stay on the theme of AI for a moment and how you're looking at ChatGPT. So
you read my mind, Simon.
Exactly. I'm super interested in how you're looking at it from also sort of across the Microsoft infrastructure, I guess, because you have a unique opportunity there with the likes of sort of Office and all the data that is there, ChatGPT, and then the whole Veeverse suite and the pieces there. How are you seeing that playing a role from a sort of learning and also beyond learning to what you were just saying from a knowledge perspective of, you know, that's that store, that management, that flow of knowledge and surfacing what's needed to the right people so you get that learning / knowledge in the flow of our day-to-day as well?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, a health warning, I'm not on the product side and nor am I sanctioned to be able to speak on behalf of those guys. But we are really excited about the the potential of this. I know next week there's going to be some announcements from our office, our future work team who manage our Office 365 product suite, as well as Viva as well. And I think there's huge potential. Now, what I would say is, and I've been reminded of this myself recently, you know, AI is nothing new to Microsoft. I think a lot of our existing work for quite some time has had AI at its center. But I think this is the next wave of progress, and it is going to be really exciting. In our context then, Simon, obviously it opens up lots of possibilities. I think, yeah, again, it will accelerate a pre-existing trend, which is how we bring learning and work together and how we simply use our workspace, and that Viva is our, you know, a work and collaboration ecosystem, how we're able to extract learning and embed learning in that workflow. And then how, obviously, the other end of that learning continuum is knowledge management and performance support. I think the opportunities are really exciting. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that develops. We on my team, we have a sort of a seat from which to watch this, but also to play what we call the role of customer zero. So we drink our own champagne, what I like to say. We like to try and do that, and we get access to a lot of the beta versions of these types of advancements. So we're going to be we have a ringside seat for this, but we also have a role to play to support our own people's development and sales organization, and to help support product development for our customers as well. So as and when we see this, we'd love to come back and talk more about it.
Just to that point, do you think GPT and tools like it are killing our curiosity, or are they helping us be more curious?
I'm a glass half full guy, type of guy, right, Paul? And I will turn it back to you in a second, because I'm interested in your point of view. I happen to think, used well, I think it will free us up to really focus on our innate curiosity and double down on that. I loved what Loretta was speaking about in the last podcast about really aligning with. And you guys, I think we're talking about the relationship between confidence and curiosity, right? And I think if we are able to use generative AI to be able to, so that we don't have to worry so much about retaining all of, there's just way too much data to try and retain, right? It's around how sophisticated and confident are we at managing knowledge and being able to access what we need when we need it? I would like to think then that would allow us the ability to be able and the confidence, give us the confidence to be able to lean into our curiosity and lead with curiosity. But, you know, I'm interested in your point of view, Paul, and, you know, what's your...
Well, I can certainly give you mine. So, and my analogy would be, I think it can enable, I think it does enable. I think if it's quite easy just to use it as the answer.
Yeah.
And of course, we quite quickly learn it's not the answer, it's just a possible starting point for an answer. I'm reminded of when, if you're ever stuck in a traffic jam and you're using any number of the mapping tools to help you find your way, you suddenly find that everybody's using the same mapping tool and everybody's being sent down the same little roads and other paths. So the problem with us just all following the instructions that come out of GPT and others, we all end up doing the same thing. So I think we do need our own curiosity to keep challenging that, would be my answer.
To add to that, I mean, you mentioned context and the ability to learn in the flow of work, two things which I'm massively interested in. One of the reasons why I like the chat about what is the platforms we need to have in place, because I think as we move forward, we're going to be harvesting data and contextual data in different ways to allow us to learn in the flow of work more and more. And that curiosity is going to be supported. It's ChatGPT got me hugely excited when I was sitting around with Paul and some of our guys, showing me them inputting questions into it. Because as you said, it comes back so rich with context, and it comes back always having gone very deep into the knowledge base of the internet. And you can put in something like, build me a curriculum about a particular topic, maybe a topic I know nothing about. And you put that curriculum that it comes back, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there that you haven't thought about because you don't know enough. So it really, I've found it to be enriching my experience and making me go, I need to figure out a few more other things before we move forward.
I love what you both have said about this, because, Paul, I totally agree with you. You know, this isn't the silver bullet, right? I mean, there's plenty of evidence to show that stuff that comes out of GPT isn't perfectly correct. But nonetheless, if you're relying on your learning agility and your curiosity and your ability to be able to synthesize in the right way, it's a great tool, right? It's a great tool. I think, Garrick, what you just said reminds me of a conversation I had with my team last week, where we were debating the use of AI in service of career development. And one of my team, you know, went away and put it into ChatGPT and came back with what ChatGPT had said about how we could use ChatGPT for career development. And it was really, really cool what they come up with. So, yeah, I guess we just have to catch up with how we use this and how we use it to fuel our curiosity rather than to necessarily replace.
As an aside, I'm writing down every time you say something that I think is a meta skill. So things like learning to learn, thriving in digital networks, personal mastery, and I've just added synthesis. How do you synthesize and how do you learn? And then how do you, you know, thrive in digital networks, links to professional learning networks too.
Yes.
And sort of reflecting on where I see it and having played around quite a lot with it as a tool, and I think it's going to be very driven by my own bias, but I think that the curiosity around the questions that you put in and then the skills around being able to apply criticality into what you get back as well. And I think particularly in the early days where we're seeing the AI is generating a lot of its own made up answers there. So the skills of being able to apply a critical lens to it, being able to identify inherent biases that may be in there, and being able to understand the context maybe differently to what the AI is. So the AI is trawling the mass, I guess, but there will be nuances in the context that it is missing because it is taking a consolidation of that information. So, yeah, the ability to actually ask better questions, refine that based on one's own understanding of the context, and to be able to see through the falsehoods that become inherent in there by applying that critical lens, and then being able to confidently execute against what's in there. And back to that strategy piece, you can get a strategy as to what to do in almost any situation from the AI. So if we've all got the same strategy opportunity, how do you differentiate as an organization then? What's the thing that makes the difference? And yeah, is it in then asking better questions, refining it down, better understanding the context of what's going to work? I think it's super interesting. And the power of questions becomes even more valuable than the answers.
Yeah, I love this focus on power of questions. You know, we do a lot of work around coaching capabilities, and for this very reason. But it also sort of ties back with this doubling down on the human capabilities as we see the rise of these types of technologies. So I feel that it actually will help drive and support our focus on those capabilities like curiosity, by the mere fact that we have fantastic capabilities on the AI side, but to balance those out and to make them effective, to your point, Simon, you know, we need great ability to ask great questions, we need ability to be able to synthesize, we need, you know, it's all of those great human capabilities that cannot be automated that will be our value, bring our love, the value that we can bring, but also will be a really healthy balance to the automation as well.
Absolutely. So bringing us back to something that you said earlier, so talking about sort of the role of learning and that it's not so much about the what as more about the how. So Microsoft is famous for the culture that is there, you know, the use of the growth mindset piece. How much do you, or what do you see going forward is the role of learning organizations? And it's a bit of a leading question, but how much is the role of the learning organization in helping to sort of adopt that culture where people can be learning, can be investing in their own skills, not feeling guilty by committing time to learning versus maybe the what of the learning itself?
I think certainly at Microsoft, it's often held. We're often held up as the poster child around learning culture, and particularly the focus around growth mindset. Before I joined, you know, as a sort of a student of OD and change, it's one of the reasons why I came. But I was also really interested to understand how true it was, and if so, you know, what's the legacy? Where were the foundations set down around this? And I've been really impressed with you know, Kathleen, our CHRO, and obviously Satya and the LT's work around this over a vast number of years. What interests me from an L&D perspective, obviously it plays right into our wheelhouse, but this isn't an L&D initiative. And again, this is something I think you guys spoke to Loretta about. This is, you know, very much a system play across the organization. So before I joined, as part of my own, I was sent one video as part of my onboarding before I joined, which was about growth mindset. It comes through on how we look at performance. It comes through on how we look at our leadership principles, how we interview and select. So it, from that perspective, it's very much something that is systemic rather than something we just look at from an L&D perspective. And I think that's the trick for any cultural dimension. In terms of the broader question around shifting from what to how, I think like many organizations, that continues to be a work in progress. And it's how we can really support. We have a great benefit to be able to take advantage of this focus on growth mindset. But I don't think that in itself is going to do the trick. We have to use that as the springboard to continue to support this mindset shift around how we learn, and to really build on that confidence, to be able to equip people, to be able to understand with skills intelligence, what are the skills they have, what are the skills they need, and how will they bridge the gap? I think we can achieve, and we are starting to achieve a lot of that through AI and through the advancement on skills intelligence. But then these meta capabilities, and in particular, I think really focusing on the how then will make sense, because we're taking care of the other pieces in tandem. So I don't know if I've sort of danced around that answer, Simon, but I'm sort of, in summary, I'm sort of saying the work isn't done here by any means. We have an amazing foundation. We see opportunities to continue to work on the what, but using skills intelligence, and then continue on the journey around how we develop the how of learning through these meta capabilities.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
Brian, building on that and this thought about learning how to learn, one of the things I know you talk about is taking smart risks and learning through failure and being okay with failure. And it's something we talk about, of course, when we're talking about curiosity, because it is often about figuring out, trying things and getting it wrong. But could you talk a bit about taking smart risks? So what does that mean? What isn't a smart risk? And do you have some examples of where that you've been involved with that in the past?
Yeah, it's a real, I'll be honest, I think we have a real hang up about failure in corporate life. You know, when I worked at Citi, our global head of innovation there, Vanessa Colella, used to tell a story which was about, you know, because she was trying to support the concept around fail fast and much more entrepreneurial approach to how we work. And she was saying, you know, in the bank, failure is often, you know, if you fail, it's usually up in the lights behind you, like on a big billboard, right? It's something which is people really, really worried about. And it's bad, right? It's the antithesis to innovation, because if you're afraid of failing, you're really not going to try anything new. You're not going to take a chance on trying something new. And it just kills off experimentation. I mean, you guys in Ludic, this is really core to what you guys do, right? So you know what this is. But I think we're really not thinking about it as failing, and entrepreneurs don't think about failing. It's just the quickest way to success. And it's thinking about it as experimentation. So I remember when we had Brené Brown come and talk to us at Citi, and she was talking about how she used to, on a weekly basis, track how many experiments were happening. She didn't say how many failures were happening. It was like, how many things are we trying to do? How many things are we trying to do? Now, obviously, there's a link to growth mindset here, because if you fail and you don't learn from that and you do the same thing again, you fail again. I mean, that's, you lose your sort of ticket to the party, as far as I'm concerned. But of course, you know, smart people don't do that. Smart people will learn from that, and they'll iterate or they'll pivot, and they'll find the right solution. Certainly, you know, I've lots of examples in my career where we've taken that approach, and so it makes a lot of sense. So I think we have to reframe failure to more around experimentation and it being the quickest way to success. And I think culturally, in big corporates in particular, many organizations and many industries have some way to go to continue to break that down. And it probably links to how we how we define success quite often.
If I may compliment you, I think that's the clearest time I've ever heard anybody make it so obvious that we have to reframe risk and failure as experimentation. It's so simple. For me, that's a huge aha with what you're saying and how you do it, because it's just that reframing and using of that language and the processes that are related to experimentation, rapid prototyping and lo-fi, hi-fi and all the rest of it.
And Garrick, I'll give you a quick example, actually. Just you've just triggered something. And I was, when I was at AstraZeneca with the COVID vaccine that we developed, this we actually really put this into play at a broad scale. Obviously, I was not involved in the COVID vaccine development, but worked with a lot of people who were. And, you know, traditionally, and Simon, you'll know this at Novartis, traditionally, bring a drug to market, 10, 15 years, a lot of sequential processes and stages of trial development. And with the COVID vaccine, we did that. It happened under 12 months. And the only way we could do that was to embrace the fear of failure, because we had to take some smart risks. But you could leverage existing research, use, you know, in order to make some smart risks around what the potential or likely outcomes might be, and then start to run some of these processes in parallel, on the basis that there's a pretty good chance that you would know what the likely outcome would be. Mm. Now, obviously, at the end, all of these things worked out, but there was an element of financial risk and a risk that it wouldn't work. But it was the only way that we could, in any way, make this happen in the time frame that was needed. And it was a fascinating experiment within the organization, right? Because this was not how this organization had typically acted. And it actually was a really interesting catalyst for a broader conversation in the company around how we support transformation.
So often that high risk scenario causes people to be more stressed and causes bosses to kind of put more constraints on things. Whereas what you're talking about by reframing it in this way, and that brilliant case, is about creating the psychological safety in which people can go fast, quickly, yeah, and safely and supported as they try and get to it. And it's that psychological safety that, as you say, allows us to be curious in that situation, with curiosity then of course opens up a context and really allows us to learn in going to new places. It's brilliant. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you were talking about the human factors, you know, the human side of things, empathy and curiosity and all the emotional things, that it's funny how that lot about what it means to be human, compassion, adaptivity. So these are the things that are coming right in the center of things again. And because we've got this technological advance, it's almost as if the great irony that the more technology that's here, the more human we're required to be. Can you tell us a little bit more about your views on curiosity and how that plays into this great game?
I completely agree. I think there is an irony and a real truth in what you've said. My definition of curiosity, you know, I'm talking to curiosity experts here, so it's a little bit intimidating to answer that question, but it's really around how we hold very lightly in our hands what we hold to be true. And you know, this is really interesting from a leadership development perspective, because really showing up with vulnerability and leading with the question, like you were saying, Simon, and being really quite sophisticated in how we do that, is not really a typical strength of a traditional leadership approach. So I think being willing to be wrong and leading with that curiosity into situations is something that I know that you guys have talked a lot about on this podcast, but I really think it is fundamental to how we need to prosper in the future. And I agree with you, Gary, as we see the amazing transformation, digital transformations that we're all privy to, I think these concepts become ever more important. And so I see them very much related in terms of playing one in tandem with the other.
Yeah, I love that. What you talk about, it's a beautiful phrase, to hold very lightly in our hands what we hold to be true. I mean, I love that.
Brian, you're obviously a golfer. Yeah, you have to hold a golf club in the same way, right? You have to hold it lightly in your hands. Otherwise, you're going to...
I'm a terrible golfer. But anyway, it's not great.
Hey, Simon, I've got one more. We'd love to ask you any questions for us, but I have got one more because we can't talk to somebody from Microsoft who are sort of at the center of shaping the future of work without asking you. So your thoughts on the future of work and, you know, and what's that like at Microsoft?
Oh, wow. Well, I think that, you know, in addition to the things I've talked about around redefining success measures, I've blogged a little bit recently about career committing, this concept of career committing. And it's perhaps sort of top of mind for me. So maybe I'll throw this into the mix at this stage. So this is this concept that, you know, we've had the Great Resignation, we had, you know, this sort of during the pandemic, these shifts in the mentality of employees in relation to work. And I think there's another one going on at the moment, which is, you know, I don't think we're moving away from some of the things that happened during the pandemic. So for example, Microsoft published a Work Trends Index each year, and the one that was published last year reported that over 50% of employees were more likely to prioritize health and well-being over work than before the pandemic, right? So that's, you know, more than half of people are fundamentally reprioritizing their relationship with work. This is, you know, really seismic. And I don't think that's going to change. It's not going to go away. But what we are seeing is that people are really thinking about how they continue to invest and develop themselves in service of what's next, and also are looking to really more proactively align around their individual purpose and what work they choose to do in service of that, their health and well-being, and the type of work that's going to develop and sustain them. So I think this, you know, we talk a lot about the contract, this new employment contract, as it were. And I think that's going to continue to evolve. There's some recent research from LinkedIn, actually, that backs up this career committing concept. And we're seeing, this is UK only, right? But I think it's an interesting proxy, perhaps, for elsewhere, where over 50% of UK employees have made positive changes at work in response to this economic turbulence that we're seeing, and that least of all in the technology sector. But interestingly, the biggest change is where people are proactively taking on new projects. So about 40% of people are reporting that they're taking on new work through projects, reinforcing that trend that I mentioned earlier on. And the LinkedIn data is also showing us that people are networking more. So about 35% increase in networking. And they're doing that to maximize opportunities to progress their career. So I think in terms of the future of work and the trends that we're seeing in the workforce, this concept around career committing, people aren't being passive. They're being really intentional about that. And it actually goes, last thing I'll say on this is, it's a reason also why at Microsoft we do track employee engagement, but it's becoming less of a focus for us, and we're much more interested in measuring how people are thriving. And by thriving, I mean focusing less about productivity and more about thriving and how we're able to help our people triangulate between their purpose, the organization's purpose, and how they can deploy and develop skills to deliver against that. So, yeah, I think pandemic fundamentally changed the shape of work. Some of that will continue to sustain, and now I think we're going to the next phase of change, and it's going to be really interesting to see how we continue to adapt to that.
It's fascinating. I mean, you talk about measuring thriving rather than engagement. I mean, we've just been through a whole 2 years of creating the Curious Advantage diagnostic, which is coming out in a few months' time. And it's remarkable that when we were thinking about how do you measure curiosity, how do you measure the things that give us access to how much of the seven C's are present, you know, context, how do you measure criticality within a team? Fascinating conversation. But the idea of measuring thriving is, number one, feels very human, but also feels challenging. How do you measure thriving? What are some of the factors that you're looking for?
Well, we're very lucky to have, obviously, to work closely with our LinkedIn colleagues, and we have some great tools, obviously, for measuring sentiment and how our what's going on for our people. So, you know, without sort of getting into the detail, there's various different ways of doing that. But, you know, I think it's this shift away from productivity to thriving, and so therefore really understanding what's going on for our people from a health and well-being perspective is just as important as the sort of the surface indicators around work and engagement. So I think it's a mixture of different elements, and we're probably looking at data sets that perhaps we haven't looked at in the past. We're reprioritizing and reorientating and looking at how we can cross-reference different sets of data to instill different set of insights around this.
So I'm conscious we're coming close to time, but is there a question you have for us before we wrap up, Brian?
I do have a question. I obviously, as you can tell, I'm a big fan of curiosity and the advantage that we can all gain from really leaning in with curiosity. But in the current climate, particularly as, you know, times are challenging for many sectors and for many companies, I'm interested in what you're seeing in terms of short-termism versus long-termism. So how sticky is this curiosity advantage? You know, we're certainly going to stay the course at Microsoft in terms of our commitment. But it's, you know, this is the time when we will all be challenged by this. And I'm just interested in what you're seeing out there and how you're able to facilitate that type of conversation.
So for me, some of the things that we've talked about over the last hour make it even more important in my mind. So the developments in AI, we're seeing activities that we maybe even a few months ago wouldn't have seen that AI could be doing suddenly taking place. And therefore, with AI, I think the power of AI is doubling every 6 months compared to sort of processing power and Moore's law of every 2 years. So if you fast forward even 6 months or a year, how much more powerful is it going to be than it is today? So for so many businesses, you look at, okay, what are we actually doing, or how many roles, what are we actually doing, and what's potentially going to get cannibalized by, at least in elements, by AI? Which would mean if you're not asking questions, if you're not curious to understand some of these new things, someone else is going to be curious. Someone else is going to be saying, how can we apply this in? And yeah, before you know it, suddenly, you know, what took us 3 months is now taking 5 minutes with an AI doing it. And maybe it's not quite as good, but that's going to make such a differentiator. So I think more and more businesses need to be asking those questions, being curious about the art of the possible, having people who are exploring these new areas, and there's very few experts in these new areas, so actually curiosity will help us to navigate through all of that. So for me, it becomes even more important just because of the rate of acceleration and change that we're seeing.
I agree. And of course, from a different perspective, if you think about the short term, where we have huge economic and social disruption around the world at the moment, in every situation there are hundreds and possibly thousands of solutions. In every situation. And that means there's always a pathway. There's an infinite pathway through a difficult situation, but it requires skills, and it also requires being open to seeing new and different things that you may not have considered before. And curiosity is at the heart of keeping people open so that they can learn from other industries and other areas, and, you know, people completely outside of their normal milieu, in which case they might find solutions to the trouble that they're facing immediately, and that might open up a pathway to value or a pathway to the future for them. And I think curiosity is the skill that's absolutely vital, so that we move, you know, we move out of sort of one or two solutions and we just see failure. You know, we actually look broad and wide to find ways forward.
Great question, Brian. It's been a great conversation. Is there one thing you'd like to leave our listeners with from this conversation?
Well, it's been a great conversation. Thanks for that answer, by the way. I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah, I wanted to, I was going to just share very briefly the three focus areas that we ask all leaders at Microsoft to fall back on to really help give us a sort of a true north, because I think it's maybe relevant to what we've talked about. The first is to bring clarity. And I think a lot of what we've talked about today is in line with this, right? So every day, every minute, synthesize the complex, take the intelligence of our people and use that to develop deep shared understanding and define a course of action. And I think that curiosity is such a fantastic tool to be able to navigate complexity, to bring clarity. The second is generate energy. And I happen to really like this one as well. I think there is, again, a connection to curiosity, particularly, again, what you guys talked to Loretta about. And again, it's to create that shared commitment and growth through good times and bad, and creating that environment where everyone can do their best. And the third one is to make things happen. So, you know, to do that, you know, that experimentation we talked about, to bring about innovations that people love and are inspired to work on. And I think, again, curiosity will help us get to the heart of what that is and what they are. So, yeah, bring clarity, generate energy, and make things happen. Just wanted to share those three principles to close it out.
Brilliant. Thank you, Brian. Yeah, we've been really looking forward to talking to you, and I know why. It's been a great, great conversation. I mean, you've covered so much. You've covered from the shift from jobs to skills, how we're going to adapt and use AI to support our learning agility and be more curious, how in learning we need to focus on the how of learning, not just the what, and start thinking about how we count our experiments and not count our failures. And actually, I love this idea of seeing failure as the quickest route to success. You also talked about how people are getting more, as you describe it, career committing, which is a lovely, lovely term. And in particular, I think we're going to all take away this idea of holding lightly what we hold to be true. It's been a really wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, Brian.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We are curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.